The modern secular society in which we live is not an easy cultural environment, and it's not an easy spiritual environment either. And more, even here in the USA, the opportunities for a strong, immediate public identity with Jesus Christ and with the Christian faith are limited. They are circumscribed. People's eyebrows go up. Questions are asked. Significant looks are exchanged. And the idea of being a professional religious worker for many of us has become at least a little unsettling, at most an image that we would like or have discarded. And so I want to explore with you in this workshop some of our struggles and challenges. I want the illustrations that you give to be real. We want to talk about where we are, and I also want to recognize that in this room there's a whole span from those who have no problem saying, I'm a navigator, I take people through Bible studies, I disciple people, etc. And then at the other extreme, those who would find that that would breach relationships and disconnect us with people whom we want to be connected to and whom we want to grow with. In very simple terms, as I think was in the brochure for the conference, I want to suggest to you a working definition of identity. Identity is how I perceive myself. Identity is, if I'm self-aware, how I really am. Identity is me. And me, incidentally, in this culture, is a very important concept. I don't mean that we as Americans are all individualistic or narcissistic, but I mean that the concept of the self in the American culture is one of the things that distinguishes it from most of the other cultures of the world. And we forget this because we're fish swimming in that goldfish bowl and we don't even realize that. But for example, the Japanese have a lot of difficulty with the concept of self because they identify themselves as part of a group, but we identify ourselves as rather distinct individuals. So our identity is how we perceive ourselves, how we truly are. Our image is how others perceive us. Also in the handout, the passage in Matthew 16, which of course is the classic passage perhaps in the New Testament on this, was mentioned, and we'll just start by looking briefly at that. In Matthew 16, verses 13 onwards, Jesus was doing some market research, and in verse 13 and 14, he asked people, who am I? Who do people think that I am? And he got the answer, John, Jeremiah, and he got the statement that he was a prophet. Then he asked Peter, and Peter, of course, said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Verse 20. And this is a little illustration of John chapter 1, verse 10, where we're told that when Jesus came into the world did not recognize him. John 1, 10. So that's what's going on here. There were real parallels, of course, between what the prophets did and what Jesus was doing when he was on earth. He was fighting the sort of spiritual battles that Jeremiah fought. He was also talking about the kingdom in the way that John the Baptist had. He was introducing and resonating with the prophets, but he, of course, was going far beyond that. He was the Messiah. He was the Son of the living God. Why do you think that he did not want the people to know that he was the Son of the living God, the Christ? What were the dynamics that caused him, two verses later, to say, don't tell anyone about me yet. Don't tell me. Don't tell other people my true identity. Yes, Jay.
The popular expectation of Messiah was radically different.
Yes.
Understanding of his mission.
Yes. Good. They expected a Messiah who would come in triumphantly, overthrow the Romans, be crowned king, rule from Jerusalem, etc., etc. The antithesis of what Jesus was about to do. Yes?
So what that means is there's instant mystification.
Yes, right. Good. Thanks, Pete. So what happens in a situation like that is that the label that people put on you sort of predetermines who you are, even when you're really not like that at all. And we've got to beware of labels. Labels are a pernicious shorthand. I used to be known as an administrator, so I'd never get invitations to come to the Great Hall and do what I'm doing now, because administrators don't do that. Label. Yes?
Am I the only one who's being bothered by this musical background that I don't think you're providing? Where's it coming from?
Go downstairs.
Be nice.
Thank you. And in Matthew 16 here, Jesus used very strong words. After he had agreed what his real identity was, you can tell that he also felt responsible for the images that people were projecting of him. The image of a prophet was obviously more in line, as we said, with where he was in his mission than the image of the Messiah or the image of the king. So he was honest, but he was keeping secrets. Let's move on then from that, which is just by way of an introduction. And I've been asking a few staff in other parts of the world how they're doing as navigators. I'm just going to give you a few quotations on what they said to me, and then we're going to talk about in a little lot later how we feel about where we are. But I think this will sort of loosen us up and realize that we may not be the only folk who have something of a problem in this area. Here's a fellow from Austria. He says, quote, "When I am most engaged in my job as a navigator, I desperately want that it doesn't look like my job." Resonate with that? Here's someone from Finland. He says, 10 years ago, we staff were the heroes. Now the common man is the hero, the layman. So 98% of our people feel a lot better around us than they did 10 years ago, because they used to yearn to be staff, and they failed when they didn't qualify. Now they can relax. I'm the one with the problem. That's from Finland. Here's someone else, a sporting type, obviously. I think he's from the Netherlands. He says, "Years ago, the navigators taught me to play the game. I played it well. Then all the rules were changed. I spent a lot of time learning the new rules. And now it turns out that no one even wants to play with any rules." So he has some issues. And here's another difficulty that we have. This, I think, was said to me by an American. Certainty, that's the sort of thing we have. Certainty in an optional area, an area of faith, an area of values, is fanaticism. One can be fanatic in the American culture only in optional areas. In non-scientific areas, such as sport or entertainment. It's very permissible to be extremely fanatic about the Denver Broncos or about sporting or entertaining heroes. But if you are fanatic, like many of us have been, in an area of values, you're feared and you're disliked. Because people who are fanatic in an area of values get images like the National Rifle Association or ACT UP, the homosexual rights group. And fanaticism is not liked in this culture. And then here's another person who did the standard thing that many of us have done. He went out to get himself a nice, high-paying job so that he could mix with people, so that he could relate to them, et cetera, et cetera. Good ideas, good reasons. And he says, "Now that I have a successful identity and a good business card, I'm almost totally unavailable to the people I want to reach." So something went wrong with his quest. And then another person says, "My strengths are in teaching and preaching. Are such things needed any longer? I feel misplaced." Do you identify with some of this? What's going on here? What sort of dissonance are you hearing? How would you characterize what these men and women were saying to me? Yes?
One person said all the rules have changed.
Yes.
With regard to identity issues and image issues.
Mm-hmm. That's right. All the rules have changed, and they didn't even consult me. Yeah. And they're still changing. You've been through a five-year process of change here in the U.S. Navigators. Do you take the view that it's all finished and now we're going to be static for 10 years? Of course not. Even if we didn't have Terry Taylor around to stimulate us, we'd still be changing all the time. And rightly so. Because society and our context are changing. And what we learn about the ministry is changing. So this isn't going to go away. What else do you notice? Good, good. That's an important point. We are grabbing onto the wrong things for identity. And we'll be talking about that as we go through this morning. Let's see, I have one other quotation here.
Now?
Yes.
Well, I think navigators have always been in a modeling ministry where we try to be an example for people to follow.
Yes.
And in years past, that was, you grew up in a navigators, and if you had some limited success, you went on and you became a navigator.
Right.
And so that's what everybody wanted to do.
Yes.
And now, like you said, the rules have changed. Now having that kind of position is no longer an asset to reach the people in this culture.
Yeah. It's particularly hard because we were brought up to think that we were the experts. And now we have been not only dethroned, such that culture doesn't think we're experts at all, but our noses have been almost rubbed in the mud because religious workers are so looked down upon by many people. Yes?
I think we can also see that God in His graciousness is unraveling the system that we gradually began to put our trust in.
Yes. Yeah, that's excellent, Chuck. There was some thin ice that we were standing on. We were getting our identity. We were getting our kicks from a number of things which had very little to do with God's grace and His imprint on our lives, but had a lot to do with status, position, function, the applaud of people, etc., etc. So I think this is a good stirring that God has got us into. I don't feel this is hopeless at all. Yes, Gary.
Something's just been going on since we've been here this week. A thought that's been rolling around in my mind and a couple of others.
A thought has been rolling in Gary's mind. Thought, please.
Like sand, you know, just
right.
Well, in the conversation with Peterson, we were talking about in Galatians 1:4 that who gave Himself for our sins to rescue us from the present evil age, and that led to a discussion about the idea of evolving theology.
Mm-hmm.
And just your conversation now begins to make me, it made me revisit that thought for a second, and I was wondering if you could just might speak to a moment about that, if you thought some about that.
The idea of evolving theology.
Yeah. How that maybe has. The idea of maybe stationary theology versus evolving may have led us to the position where we are and maybe even make us address this question.
Part of the reason for the SRM, although we were honest when we said that it didn't have a hidden agenda, but part of the reason for doing it was that it might stir up our theology and rearrange the pieces and introduce some new flavors. And I think it's done this. It's done this in my life, and I know from testimonies that it's done it in many other lives. But there's a very good book by a Catholic teaching in Chicago. His name is Robert Schreiter. He's written a book called Constructing Local Theologies. And this traces in the Catholic Church the evolution of local theologies. The Jesuits changed their theology when they went to China. They had to. They got in trouble with Rome for changing it, but they did the right thing. They changed it again in India. They changed it again in Latin America. And, of course, liberation theology has some Marxist excesses, but it was a contextualized theology. And the point that we may overlook is we think, well, America's America, America's a Christian nation, America is homogeneous. That's strictly for people who are going overseas. Not at all. I think we have to construct local theologies to meet the needs of the people whom we are working with and befriending here in our individual cities and suburbs. That to me is quite an important point, and that relates to what you're saying. Yeah. so easily do the things that I hold as strong beliefs or convictions become things that really freeze me. Or, as a secular person said, what I think I know is the enemy of what I ought to know. And a real tendency, particularly when you're middle-aged, comfortable and so forth, my age, you've got to be very, very careful to keep getting yourself into situations where you find people who disagree with you and people you can learn from. Yes?
Donald, two questions. What was the last name of that author?
Schreiter, S-C-H-R-E-I-T-E-R, Constructing Local Theologies. It's a little academic, but if you dig through it, by about halfway through, he's got marvelous examples. See, we think, oh yeah, there was Catholic theology, and then Luther and Calvin came, and now there's Reformation theology, and so we're the good guys, the Catholics are the bad guys. Life is not at all like that. No.
Well, one thing that would help, since I'm an associate staff, and I had a job in corporate America, the changes in many, many large corporations parallel the changes with the Navigators.
Yes.
And so a lot of the people that you will be interacting with, both in discipling but also non-believers, you can relate to the changes.
Yes.
The feelings, the fears that they have, you can relate to. So don't sell yourself short on that.
No. See, that's very helpful. You know, when we first came up with the idea that vision and values and relationships were a good thing in the Navigators, I found myself mentally patting myself on the back. These are good insights. These are biblical. And then you open half a dozen secular books by Peters and other people, and you find they were there 5 years ago, and then you sort of crumple in a heap on the floor, and it's a little tough. But the fact that secular people are producing truth doesn't mean we should allow them to get away with a monopoly of the truth. We have the true truth. Now, I want to ask you to do something here. I want you to take a piece of paper, and I want you to write down in just a few words why you came to this seminar. Putting it negatively, what is the problem you're wrestling with? Putting it positively, what is the solution that you hope to obtain? Why are you here? And then we're just going to read some of these out, and we may put them on the flip chart. I need to take a little market survey here of what's going on in our minds.
Learn how to communicate what I do to the spectrum of my audience in such a way that conversation continues.
Good. Little pain hidden in there somewhere. Once upon a time it didn't, right?
Right. You got it.
Okay.
Exactly the same.
Uh-huh.
Phrase slightly different.
Yes. Gary.
I wrote that. I was interested in being stimulated in my thinking about how I can more effectively serve the
Lord. Some of these have to do with our culture, the times we're in, understanding the times. And America is in an identity crisis. Identity doesn't fit either of my two subcultures. And that's where I'd like to start and then come back to some of these other ones. I'd like us to spend a little time just identifying together in groups what it is in our modern, secularized, pluralistic American culture, or if you don't buy all those words, just the people you know, what it is among the people you know that are the things that are really relevant for us as we work at being a channel of Jesus Christ into their hearts. There are some good things and there are some definitely bad and challenging things. Let me give you an example of an obvious difficult thing. We were brought up, as we said earlier, as the religious professionals, the experts, the people with the Christian business card. We are living in a society, I believe, where authority is thoroughly mistrusted. John Stott. This the modern age detests authority and worships relevance. We're in danger of looking authoritarian and sounding irrelevant. We've got a double problem on our hands. Now, I'd like to take a little time to find in the culture the good things and the bad things that relate to this specific issue of my image and my identity. How do I present myself to the people whom I wish to become fellow pilgrims with me? Does that make sense? We'll just do it in groups for, say, about 10 minutes, and then just get someone to fire off a few key ideas from your group. I've mentioned one, the idea of anti-authoritarianism. You know, another thing, just to sort of stimulate you and show you where we're tracking, is what someone's called the pickup mentality that we all have. I'll take a little quotation from this book. I'll tell a little story about this person. And then I'll go to another seminar at 10 o'clock. And I really don't care to get committed to anything. Commitment is dangerous. Commitment is asking too much of me. I just like to dance around on the surface a bit and have some fun for tomorrow we die. The pickup mentality, which has been drilled into us. A little bit of this, a little bit of New Age, a little bit of, you know, lotus position meditation won't do anyone any harm. That's a very real thing in our society today, and we have to combat that. Okay? Divide into groups of about, five or six, and just go for 10 minutes on the matter of what are the salient features of American culture that relate to this. Yes, Gary?
I was wondering if you just restate in America we're becoming a fractured family.
Fractured. Mm-hmm. Okay. Many broken people, too. And one of the curious things, before I just talk about that for a moment, one of the curious and important things about us, the navigators at this stage, is we are moving away from some of the cultural norms at the speed of light. Let me just take one example of that statement. You probably got the recent Perspectives article by Jim Peterson, the thing that Terry Taylor sends out. Basically, the new paradigm, if you like, in the navigators is that we don't count things, and particularly we don't count people, because that can be degrading, can be manipulative, and so on, right? This idea that the way in which we figure out what we are about and whether we are being blessed by God in doing it is no longer to count how many are in your Bible study or how many came to Christ in your ministry last year. And this is still very countercultural, especially during this fortnight of the Olympics with all the statistics. Another quote from Stewart. For Americans, achievement has to be visible and measurable. Americans will be very sensitive to praise or blame. They demand feedback. Signs of friendship or appreciation are a necessity. The essential quality is measurability. If something is real, it must be quantifiable. There is no quality or experience that cannot at least be partially quantified. Success and failure are measured by statistics. I think that's still largely true in our culture. And we are going countercultural as a community of disciples in this respect and in some other respects as well. So we need to be alert to that. That creates dissonance, even though I think what we're doing is entirely right for these times. Yes, Roger.
Sometimes you feel in America coming back, but there's certain parts of America that are kind of taking leadership over other parts and kind of forcing other parts to follow their part.
Yes.
But it might not be their part in the culture, like yeah. The Midwest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's true. Mm-hmm. I'm not in any sense an expert on American cultural segments, but is it not true that usually the East Coast and the West Coast are somewhat ahead of the middle?
But even in the navigators, yeah. I mean, some of the things that are happening
right.
Wasn't such a problem for Midwesterners.
No.
But these things you're talking about.
Yes.
Maybe has been.
Yeah, I would say so. And the reason, part of the reason, Roger, that it's a problem for others is because the society is changing faster in some of those areas in ways which it wouldn't be changing so fast in the Bible Belt, I think.
No.
Okay, let's just have a look here. These are things about the culture that are relevant to focusing on our image and identity. I think some of the positive things here, as has been said, helping people, that gives us a good opening. The idea of family, someone said, is still a desperate need, getting more so as families fall apart very, very quickly. We are, if we do it properly, in the pain avoidance business, surely. Although we'd have to do some, you know, negotiating with the people we're with in order to make that become clear. But I would say most of these things are challenges rather than success factors for us. Okay, let's move along here. On this outline, we've talked about one, we've talked about number two, some of the things that other people I mentioned and some of you have mentioned. Why does this concern us? We've expressed that, why we're here this morning. We've talked a little bit about modern Americans. And the idea of expectations before we come right down to what is our identity and what should it be and why is it useful. Just one more exploratory thing here. Expectations. What sort of expectations rest upon our shoulders? Who is laying expectations upon us? We are. We as individuals, right? Good. What? Who else? Our culture, yes. There's a piece of paper here which is called The Navigator's Purpose, Values, Task, Functions, and Faith Directions. Someone's laying expectations on us. The navigators. We. You know, and that's not to attack or defend this piece of paper, but there are collective navigator expectations. I saw in a recent issue of Perspectives that Terry writes, the one he wrote, the first one, he made some statement along the lines of, well, if you don't fit in this area, you probably better go and do something else. He put it rather more graciously. But there are some expectations there. Gary?
Donors.
Donors. Very difficult one for some of us.
Especially churches.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Now, see, that's in the matter of measurement. Churches are going pro-cultural. Churches have been taught that if it's a, Christianity is as measurable as anything else. So the names of your converts, please. What's going on? And we're just missing that.
Just to reinforce that point of where that's going.
Yeah.
In September, myself and several others are doing a consulting job with Riverside Church in New York City, moving into a total policy management like this one from the church.
Hmm. Really? Oh.
Is it quality management or quantity?
Yeah. There are, as you know, 35 or more Christians.
That's very private information, but I share it because we're talking about.
Yeah. There are 35 or so Christian organizations in this city, and one of the leaders of one of them is meeting with me. We've met three times. His question for me is, how can my mission agency, based in Colorado Springs, introduce MBO on a worldwide basis so that we know what everybody is doing? Huh? I say, I'm not the right person. So he said, well, listen, let's have a deal here. You tell me what you did 20 years ago, and you tell me why you think it wasn't a good idea, and we'll see if we can adapt it and use it. But they're so dead set on, they have monthly reports in this Christian organization. They don't seem to do anything with those reports when they come in, but they file them, and it does give the illusion of control for their senior leaders at their equivalent of Glenerie. Now, I don't want to be patronizing about that. We've been through that. We thought it was a great idea at one time, too. So it's not to poke fun at these anonymous people, but it's to say that out there in the Christian community, there are a lot of people going very different direction from us. Yes, which increases our problem. Yes.
You know, I labored under that for a long time, and I'm really grateful for the changes. But, you know, when those changes happened, nobody apologized. Nobody said, hey, we realized we did something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Just changes came.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a sense in which I still labor under that paradigm, you know, because it's not been reconciled in a way. Now, you hear you talk and stuff, and then I got some kind of warmth. Morning at breakfast, some of that is getting
reconciled, but it's still a problem.
Well, I think we need collectively to work at this. My response to you is that I feel that we, including me, have been very slow at going back to people whom we used or whom we gathered into groups to do our ministry with us and apologizing to them, and in some cases asking their forgiveness. And so I don't think it's necessarily just a headquarters problem. It's a generic navigator issue, and we all need to work at it. We need to clean up some of the mess that we left behind. Efforts have been made to do this, genuine efforts. Efforts in this room. I've seen some of the U.S. leaders gather here and publicly have a little service of repentance for some of the things in the past. But then the balancing fact is what we did in the past was in the light of what God led us in at that time, and hindsight is not a fair way to judge anyone, because we've moved on and the situation has moved on. We need to be very sensitive not to overreact. One of the things I'm very interested in, end of digression after this sentence, is the place of tradition in a group such as the Navigators, and I believe that place is very, very important. We need to develop a right understanding of tradition and what it does for us. Okay, some expectations we were talking about. So we lay expectations on ourselves. The Navigators collectively lay expectations on us. Our donors lay expectations on us. The people we work with, or the people we minister with, or the people we serve, obviously lay expectations on us. So we have this whole mass of expectations coming in on us all the time. Our spouses. Yes, that's right, Bill, Georgia, our spouses. Now, in the light of this, let me suggest that two things that characterize the life of Christ were serenity and confidence. Jesus was serene and confident. As the poem by Thomson, The Hound of Heaven, says, there was deliberate speed, majestic instancy. So I want to ask you the question, in the light of all these expectations, in the light of the fact that we seem to be going countercultural, in the light of the fact that we are here because we have some problems and some issues, what would be the key, in your view, that would make you more serene and confident in your role as NAV staff? And we're getting close here to the heart of the matter of our identity. We've sort of laid out our cards on the table. But what would make us more serene and more confident? It's not just that we want to be at peace, that could be selfish, but we want to have the confidence always to give a reason for the hope that is in us. Serenity and confidence in what God has called us to do. How would you characterize, if you had to help your brother or sister sitting next to you this morning, regain their sense of serenity and confidence in their calling and in who they are and in the fact that they're here for significant purposes in which God is well pleased? What would you say to them? Yeah.
Soldier made a comment in one of his writings that all of our errors and mistakes and stuff come from an inadequate concept of God. And I think that by and large, getting to know God well, not knowing about Him, but knowing Him, knowing His character, that can't help but change us to be like Him. Mm-hmm. If we want to be like Him in the area of serenity and confidence,
good, very good, in fact. I think that is very foundational, and that would be clear to most of us, that our identity needs to be rooted in God. That's absolutely so. Now, does anyone have an example of some crisis they went through where they had to reestablish that rootedness in God, or some period where you were able to rebuild what you're talking about, to get close to God again?
I think that's been the story of my life.
A Sharper Image, which is a pretty revealing title, isn't it, about our society? But when you lose your concept of grace, then you're reduced all the time to trying to polish your image. As Ed knows, years ago, I used to be very, very shy, very, very introverted. I would blush if a woman looked at me. Just couldn't handle myself at all socially. And someone told me one day, it's just plain selfishness. You're so preoccupied with yourself, and you're so unaware of the grace of God. And you just have to stop trying to make yourself look good and open up a channel for God to work in your heart. And that was, you know, big, big lesson for me that I'm still working on. Yeah.
I think grace is the second step. But we often get to grace in our whole, just about all of evangelical, most of evangelical religion, as I could tell, tells the good news and sort of passes quickly over the bad news.
Identity is we refuse to be even honest with ourselves. We're going around pretending to ourselves to be certain things which God never gifted us to be. And for goodness sake, we need to break out of that. Because it's wasting God's time, and it's not doing his kingdom much good. Yes.
The law comes before grace. That's
yes. Yes. Yes, Ed.
Donald, one of the biggest troubles I had was about 12, 14 years ago, we decided...
I think you will have a ministry in some of our lives as we talk to you and observe you and so on. Because in that quotation I read at the beginning, we, the full-timers, now have the problem. 10 years ago, you had the problem. For some reason, you didn't come on staff, so you go and do something normal while we are the priestly elite. Now it's the other way around. We are the people who feel on the shelf. We are the people who feel that the goodies that we have to offer are not necessarily needed. And you are the people who have the joy of being in the front lines. And it's called a theology of work. And I don't know how it is in the American Navigators, but in about a half hour ministries overseas, we're beginning to grapple with the theology of work. Because our previous theology was horrible. It was just sub-biblical. It was,
I think about a great
yeah.
Example of that guy who left
yeah. Is using his gifts. It's cause for singing, I think, in heaven. Okay, we probably, I don't hear the sounds of people drinking outside, but it does seem to me that there ought to be a coffee break down there somewhere. Where's Gary? What, do you think there's a? Do you want to look through the window and see if there's a coffee break?
Ted Rice just went out to check, so if he doesn't
come back. Okay, we'll wait a couple of minutes. Yeah. We'll wait a couple of minutes. It is there. Okay, we'll take a 15-minute break now, and then when we come back. What we're going to do is I'm going to ask you the question, who are you? We're going to talk about that. And we're going to talk about the difference between image and identity. And then I want to get to practical issues. You might be thinking about that. For example, the ones I've noted down is just to show you the sort of things so as you can be percolating on this. Working at home. Most of us work at home. That makes us look slightly odd in the eyes of the people around us. Access to people, manipulative friendships. If I have a heavy secular job, I don't have any time. If I have a heavy full-time Christian worker job, I have too much time and nobody to work with. So either way, I'm in very practical terms, I'm skewered. No money. What do I tell my donors? You're not talking here to any particular person other than just yourself. How would you describe yourself in 20 words or less? What is your identity? And I'd like to suggest that that is different from some of the roles that you perform. A role could be like a counselor, a navigator, a consultant, a bookkeeper, an administrator, a friend. But the issue is, who are you? Now, you may think this is very straightforward. We know that. That's sort of Christianity 101. But we do tend to get our role, our image, and our identity tangled up from time to time. Who are you? Just give that a little thought for a moment, and then I'll ask several of us to tell us if it's not too private and personal. Could that verge a little bit out of who am I into what am I doing? I am engaged in fellowship, I am engaged in glorifying, and so forth. It's coming close to my main Christian functions, perhaps. But it's a good statement. Who am I?
By the grace of God, I am what I am.
I am what I am. Roger. You've lived in too many cultures. You're too careful. Okay, so you're just a whole bundle of God's grace. Thank you, Roger. Yes.
I'm beginning to identify myself more as being loved by God.
I'm loved by God. Yes. 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 So I am a loved person. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyone else? Chuck, who are you?
I feel more like a reality when I got up. I think of myself as a large creation and you're not God's son.
Yes, yeah, okay. Yes.
I feel like a pilgrim.
A pilgrim.
A pilgrim. Mm-hmm. Growing in my appreciation of God's grace, that I'm a sinner who doesn't deserve His grace, but it's pouring it out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, Gary.
I connect with that word, pilgrim.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm a pilgrim. Was it hard to express your identity? Is it a level at which you often think? Or do you just take this for granted?
Yeah. To express it without falling into roles right.
Yes, now. It is. Yeah, it really is. Okay, do you think your identity changes over time? No? No?
I think it deepens.
It deepens. Okay. Yes? Now, for example, in my identity, I'm thinking more in the last year or so about what it means to be an image bearer. I yet never used to think about that. That was just, you go through Genesis 1 at such speed that, you know, you're off the launch pad and into other things. But now I'm going back much more to Genesis 1 and 2 and thinking about that aspect of my identity. There's a very rich study. Yes?
Do you think we have to build anything into that that distinguishes us from the 5 billion other individuals out there?
Perhaps our identity is not so much different from the others, but it lies in our consciousness of the fact that it is God-related. Because assuredly the 5 million others would not say the sort of things that you have just said this morning, most of them. Would you agree? Yeah. They don't know their identity. That's why they're so busy building images. Ken.
To me, the identity that I draw out of Genesis 1, which would be my basic answer, implicit in that is ownership. And
yes.
Either I have tried to steal away that ownership or to break off any kind of an ownership relationship. I mm-hmm. want to possess this myself.
Mm-hmm.
And those kinds of struggles
mm-hmm.
That I see in myself and that I see in the world around
mm-hmm.
me.
So those are pride struggles. You want to run the show. I mean, you have plenty of room for God, and you value His instructions, but basically you'd like to do it your way.
Right.
Yeah.
I want
to own
the franchise. I
have yes. Yeah. Thank you for your honesty.
We defined identity earlier as how we
see ourselves.
How I perceive myself. Well, that's it. Yeah, my identity has changed a lot.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And
yeah.
It's still changing.
Yeah. Well, I agree with the person somewhere here, maybe it was you, who said it deepens. I don't think, if I've studied the scriptures and I have a right relationship with God, I think my identity is really moored in him. But I think my ways of expressing it, my understanding of the value of my identity, and the praise that I give to God for the way that he's made me and made you, really deepens and changes and grows as we mature. I think that's part, as we are progressively changed into the likeness of Christ, to the extent that we are aware of that, then we are becoming more like our Lord. We are reflecting, 2 Corinthians 3:18 and 4:1, more of his glory. Yes?
My image is very fluid. It has to do with the relationship with God, but it seems to be tied in with my emotions. And I sometimes see him as the majestic creator, and sometimes he's my master, and other times he's my friend. Mm-hmm. And so my image is all from one day or even from 1 hour changing.
Yes.
In that relationship.
But your basic consciousness that you are locked into him, that you belong to him, doesn't change. You see him in different ways. But you relate to him perhaps in a fairly similar way. At least when you're not walking in sin, you do. Yeah. Okay. So I want to suggest to us, as we've been hearing, that identity is a solid thing, a permanent thing, but a growing thing. And as we learn from the Lord and from one another, and as we reflect on the way he's made us, we can not have a sharper image, but a sharper identity. And that's important in these turbulent days, because if we're uncertain at this level, then when we get to the level of image, we're going to be really tossed to and fro. We need to have a clear identity. And I'm so glad that we didn't root it, us men, in our work. That's one of the big problems that men have, and working women nowadays to some degree. Okay? We root it in our work. Who are you? Well, I'm a vice president at McDonald's. No, that's the answer to a different question. That's a good answer, but it's the wrong answer. Okay, now, identity and image. My wife watches more TV than I do. She tells me that there's a tennis star, Andre Agassi, and he's promoting some shoes, I expect, and he keeps saying, image is everything. Any of you seen that commercial? Image is everything. That's about where our culture is. You sense, I think, we touched on this earlier, a real cleavage between our image or images and our identity, right? And sometimes it can be acutely painful. There's a navigator who holds the world record for pain in this area. His name is Don Nedenrep. He has been trying to get into Yugoslavia for approximately 10 years. He's finally given up, and he's now in Bulgaria, and he has a great success in Bulgaria. But in his 10 years of trying to get into Yugoslavia, he assumed or put on 9 different identities. He was an import-export trader. He was studying Serbo-Croatian history. He enrolled on a government course that allowed him to spend 3 months out of the year in Belgrade. Each one of these things just collapsed in flames. And Don came back here for a lot of recuperation. He's a brave man and a fine, fine colleague. But we put on him a burden which was not what we should have done. We said, your job is to get into Yugoslavia. You figure out how to do it. And poor Don went through 9 identity crises. And he was lying in several directions at once. Because you say one thing to the U.S. consul, you say another thing to the people you're discipling, you say another thing to the navigators on your W-2 form and the American government, etc., etc. We serve the Prince of Truth. We cannot live in a web of lies. Now, we've had to learn this because when we first went into restricted countries, we lived in the idea of a cover. I'll do anything so long as it gives me a visa and it's not immoral. And then you move on from that. You move towards having a valid identity. Yes, Don?
You use the word identity crisis. In that case, it would be more called an
image. I should. Yeah, thank you very much. That was careless. It was more an image crisis. He was so busy projecting all these images. Thank you, Don. Yes?
You're saying that our identity has nothing to do with what we do
I would describe my identity as a cluster, but the root of that cluster, the controlling thing, the central thing, has to do with my relationship with God and the way he has made me and his purposes for me. Out of that come, like barnacles, other things, what I do, who I'm married to, where I live. My identity is British. My identity is middle class. My identity is grandfather. That's all part of it. But the problem is when the barnacles become the central thing. Isn't it sad when you find a family where even the wife is calling her husband granddad? Because the identity of that family is now rooted around the grandchildren. And the husband and wife can't easily talk about much except the weather and the grandchildren. So that you see the poor man's image changing, so he's got this permanent label for just a segment of his life, or her life. Maybe you do that in your family. If so, I apologize for being negative. But I don't mind being called granddad. I don't think that my children should call me granddad. And this happens in parts of my family. Okay. And it's not even what I do in the sense of whom I work for. See, one way that I have of describing myself, you say, what do you do in the Navigators, Donald? I don't say I work for X or I'm on Y team. I wrote down here three things that I really cared about that I think I do or try to do. I'm a midwife, helping others to create. I'm a catalyst, helping others to combine. And I'm an enabler, helping others to be competent. Now that, you know, if I go and work for IBM, I'll still have those roles because they relate to my gifts. They don't relate to some position or some area of the country. Okay, on to image. We all sense a gulf between our identity and our image, right? We've talked about this. How important is this, and what practical steps can we take to improve matters? Let me just bring in a couple of illustrations from Scripture here. We want to be very careful at this point, because we can go too far. We know that the gospel was foolishness to the Greeks and a stumbling block to the Jews. Okay? We know that Jeremiah and almost every other prophet had severe problems with their audiences. So the issue is not how can I present my image that everybody is comfortable with me. If that is the issue, Jeremiah totally failed. He had no success at all. So the issue is not how to make myself comfortable in American society and still believe that I belong to God. But the issue has to do with how can I become a relevant channel for the gospel of Jesus Christ to reach others. Agreed? So we've got to be careful here. Not comfort, but what I call serenity and confidence in my internal mechanism. I believe that you and I have a gyroscope that keeps us going because it's God-locked. And we keep, like a compass swings away from true north, it will swing back again. But now we have this practical issue. So you're dealing with these folk one day and these folk the other day. How do you keep adjusting your image? Should you adjust your image? And how correct is it to keep adjusting your image without, in fact, just being deceitful or manipulative? Let's talk about that for a little bit. I want to hear from you because I live in a Christian headquarters working among Christian people who all give credence to the sorts of things that I do, but I want to hear from you because you're on the front line. How do you handle this matter of your image, Bill?